And boom, here we go. It's 8:08 on WCCO. I'm Laura Oakes in for Susie Jones this morning. The star of the show this hour, though, as you all know, is Mr. Bruce Helmer from Wealth Enhancement Group. This is Your Money, and we have a special show this week. Ask Bruce anything, and I mean anything. I want you people to ask Bruce the most personal questions you can come up with, because I know he's going to have some great, fun answers. Again, the WCCO talk and text line for your calls and questions, 651-461-9226. I want to emphasize the talk part of that talk and text line. Call us. We want to hear your voices. Don't hide behind that texting machine. It's time to talk and have some real conversations with Bruce. So, Bruce, good morning. Take it away.
Hello, Laura. Hey, before I get going, I was trying to remember, how long have we known each other? It's got to be over 20 years now, doesn't it?
I think so, yes. Whenever I started working here and you started having your show here, I know we've known each other for decades, and you're the best. You are the best.
Oh, no, you're the best. It's great to be with you in this format. We see each other at a lot of things and do some stuff together, but it's nice to have you on Your Money with me. Hey, I want you to jump in, too. I know I always... if you have a financial question, chances are there's listeners that have the same question. But I wanted to start with one thing. And again, thank you for asking people to join in the show, because any financial question, anything people have got on their mind, there's no limit. I'll do the best I can. Peg is taking the week off. She's got a personal important trip that she needed to do, so she's getting a well-deserved week off. As frequent listeners to the show know, Peg's a lot smarter than I am, but I'll do the best I can. But there's some old business I want to go back on. In a recent show, we did a segment, Laura, about HSAs, health savings accounts. And just for people that don't know or missed that show, a health savings account is a strategy available to people if you have a high deductible health insurance plan. Now, some people should not have a high deductible plan. If you've got, you know, teenage drivers or young kids that go to the doctor a lot, you probably don't want a high deductible plan. But if you don't go to the doctor much, healthcare expenses are historically, typically pretty low, and you have a high deductible plan and it makes sense for you to save that premium by having a higher deductible plan, you're eligible for these health savings accounts. And what I like about them so much, anyone that listens to this show has heard Peg and I talk about comparing tax deferred types of IRAs, traditional IRAs, where you get a deduction for the contribution, but you pay the taxes when you take the withdrawal. This would also include traditional 401ks, 403bs, 457s. And then there's Roth, where you don't, Roth IRA, Roth 401k, you don't get a deduction for the contribution. But if you allow the funds to stay there for at least 5 years or until age 59 and a half, whichever is longer, you can take tax-free withdrawals. You don't have to pay any taxes on the gain. Well, the beauty of the health savings account, the HSA, it's like combining the best of both worlds of traditional IRA with Roth IRA, or we get to have our cake and eat it too. You get a deduction for your contribution, and you get tax-free withdrawals as long as those withdrawals are for qualifying health care expenses. So this is a very effective tool that, in my experience, a lot of people that have a high deductible plan and they are eligible to use are either not using it or they're not funding it to the extent that they possibly could. So that's what we had talked about. But a listener wrote in and said one important distinction about these HSAs: if you're on Medicare, you can no longer contribute to an HSA. But, and I think Peg and I talked about that, Laura, but the listener pointed out that Medicare typically backdates. In other words, if you file for Medicare, they backdate and go back 6 months. So if you're planning to retire and apply for Medicare, you should actually stop contributing to your HSA 6 months before your retirement date. If you keep contributing right up to the retirement date, you could potentially overfund the HSA, and there can be some penalties and some detrimental impact to that. So, and the reason, and it may sound funny, why would you predate it by 6 months? But people that apply for Medicare, you know, part A and part B, they get 6 months of retroactive coverage. And again, it invalidates your ability to contribute to an HSA, but the government did this to ensure that people coming off employers' health insurance would not inadvertently find themselves uninsured in that transition to Medicare. So they actually backdate it. They're trying to do us a favor, but we might inadvertently get caught in a little trap there if we contribute to the HSA for too long. So a listener contributed that, and I appreciate that, and they're absolutely right. And Peg and I probably did not hit on that the day that we talked about that segment on HSAs. So, Laura, I have a couple more things, but I would defer. I will only use the information that I've got if we need it. But if you've got questions or if listeners are texting or calling, let's let listeners and let's let you drive our topics.
All right. Thank you, Bruce. We do have a couple of questions from listeners on our talk and text line. Is there a disadvantage to having an IRA that has a beneficiary destination of a trust designation? I bet that's supposed to be.
Yeah, actually, that's a great question. There are potential disadvantages in naming a trust. The taxes and some of the complications. And by the way, let me back up a little bit, Laura. So when they say trust, the texter, what they're probably doing is they're describing a revocable living trust, which is sometimes used instead of a will. There's a will or there's a trust, and I'm not going to go down the road of distinguishing between the two and why we would use one over another. And oftentimes we fund the trust or we put assets in the trust or assets are owned by our trust rather than owned individually. And from a planning standpoint, that can make some sense. But on a retirement plan, it actually is easier and better and more efficient if you name an individual beneficiary. And if the beneficiary is an individual beneficiary, they're going to inherit and they're going to have to pay the taxes at their tax rate. So let's take a traditional 401k or a traditional IRA. I put in my contributions. Every year that I make a contribution, it reduces my taxes in that tax year. The amount of the contribution is deductible from my income. So I get tax benefit just by making the contribution. And then I don't pay any taxes along the way on any of the earnings or any of the gains. I don't get any 1099s. But then when I start to withdraw the money, I pay the taxes. But if I die with that money and leave it to somebody, they're going to pay the taxes. And that's okay. I think people think, well, if I put it in a trust, we can avoid that. But trust tax rates can actually be higher and more complicated. And there isn't an advantage that I can think of. Now, the beneficiary on these retirement plans, if you're married, is automatically your spouse unless they disclaim that or unless they sign off and say, I don't want it. So if you as a couple have made a decision that you're going to leave your retirement plan to your children rather than to one another, that's fine, but you have to indicate that. If you indicate nothing, it's automatically going to be your spouse, and then the spouse and only the spouse has the availability to actually take over that retirement plan as though it were always their own. And they don't have to take withdrawals or disbursements or spend the money right away. They can continue to defer the taxes and let it go. It's called a spousal IRA. But if it's anybody other than the spouse, and most often we see this as adult children, they have to begin to take withdrawals and they have to deplete the value of that account over a 10-year period of time. But I would say, you know, 99.9% of the time, you're better off with an actual named beneficiary. And you can change that beneficiary. I think sometimes people think they want to name the trust to make it permanent, but in case they change their mind or somebody passes away or there's a divorce or whatever, you can change the beneficiary. That's not an irrevocable decision. But again, it's always going to be your spouse unless you decide otherwise or unless the spouse disclaims that. And again, I just don't see an upside of having a retirement plan naming a trust as the beneficiary. Laura?
All right. Thank you, Bruce. We have a caller on the line. Wade, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I'm a treasurer for a church, and we're beginning our stewardship program. And one of the vehicles we're talking about is a CGA, or a charitable gift annuity. And my question, Bruce, for you is, if one of the people or some of the people decide they want to give a gift to our church, do we as an institution, as a church, have to invest the money for the CGA, or do we use an outside party? Our concern is that we'd want to be in the investment business, yet we understand if they decide to make, rather than the QCD, put money out of their IRA into a CGA, that we would have to do the actual physical business of investing. And that's my question. Do we as a church have to do it, or do we use an outside party? What's the program with a CGA?
Hey, Wade, thanks for listening, and thanks for a really good, really insightful, thoughtful question. So this is not uncommon. It's not, you know, our core competency, but it's not rare or uncommon that we take on this role for an organization and invest the money. And whether it's an annuity like you're describing, or whether it's just an investment portfolio, but you're right, you don't want to be in the investment business. And so you want to probably, you know, defer that to somebody that knows how to do it better than you do. And usually, you know, whether it's a church or whether it's a some other charitable organization, some 501c3, we manage money for a military group, you know, is one of the ones that comes to mind for me. There's usually a charter that will specify how aggressive or how conservative you can be, or what strategies or what investments you can and can't do. Because, if, for example, your church might not want somebody to come in there and put 100% of the money in aggressive stocks and try to go for really robust, you know, returns on investments, but also take great risk to do it. So the charter might say, we only want a certain percentage exposed to stocks, or we don't want anything exposed to stocks. You know, you can use money markets and CDs and bank deposits and try to get the best interest rate you can, but we don't want to take any risk on this money. Or there'll be some limitation or something spelled out in the charitable charter. As the treasurer, you probably have access to that document. But these annuities that you describe are a good way of giving to a charity. And again, in my experience with the charities come back to me, and I know in my own charitable giving, they look for short-term money or money immediately to help the church or the charity, whatever it is. But they also like these deferred gifts like an annuity, or sometimes even, you know, a life insurance policy that upon my death, this money will go to the church or to the charity. And that's not going to help them immediately, but that shows legs or staying power to the charity, that we've got these future endowments coming in from an annuity or from a life insurance death benefit. So, yes, we want money today to help us immediately, but it helps the long-term cause and gives us credibility or staying power if potential donors know there's money coming out there in the future from these annuities or from life insurance. So I'm going to guess, Wade, that there's some kind of a charter that outlines what you can and can't do. And yes, you do not want to get into the investment business. And there are people like me out there that will help you do that. Obviously, for a fee, we're charitable. I'm charitable, but I do get paid for my work. But I think, you know, again, when you look at the fee and the value added of somebody to help you do that, net, it's worth it. And just like I would tell any client, if you engage my services for anything, and whatever my fee is, if over a reasonable period of time you don't see the value, if you can't see that you're better off with me than without me, you should fire me. That's what I would do if I hired someone and they weren't doing the job. So, yes, there's professional help that you can get. And thank you for agreeing to do that, because I know it's time-consuming and a thankless job. And I hope your church is grateful for you making that time commitment, because I know you're going to put some time into it. Laura?
It is Ask Bruce Anything on Your Money this morning. Please call us. Please text us. We'd really love those calls. The line, regardless, either way, 651-461-9226. And Bruce, another texter is asking, why would anyone have more than 20 different stocks in their portfolio from a private investor standpoint or an advisor?
Thanks, Laura. I suspect the reason for the texter saying that is if you look at the S&P 500 index, which a lot of people do to judge the success or failure of the stock market, the performance is really driven by about five or half a dozen stocks. And so a lot of people think, well, why would I buy the other 495? Why don't I just buy the five good ones? And the same thing has been said to me before about why should I invest in anything else besides the S&P 500 or the Dow 30, maybe as another example. Why should I buy little companies? Why should I buy foreign companies? Why wouldn't I just buy these big, large cap, well-established companies that usually do well? And the answer is diversification. The S&P 500 or the Dow 30 have in common, they are both large cap domestic stock indexes. So if you buy that index or a portion of that index, you're only buying domestic large cap stocks, which I will admit recently have outperformed global stocks and small cap stocks. But that's not always true historically. There's periods of time where small cap does a lot better than big cap. There's periods of time where global stocks or emerging market stocks have done much better than domestic. So we believe in diversification. We believe in a lot of stocks. In fact, if you're going to do an individual stock portfolio with Wealth Enhancement Group, we have certain minimum investments that we want. We don't have a minimum as a company. You could put, a few thousand dollars in an IRA, but if you do that with us, we're going to use funds so we can get the proper diversification, because we believe that unless you have a certain amount of assets, we can't diversify properly using only individual stocks. But if you have enough money to invest that we can diversify, we're going to buy probably roughly 100 individual stocks if we create an all-stock portfolio. It is going to be more than 20, and it's not going to be just domestic large cap. We're going to have small cap in there. We're going to have domestic stocks. We're going to have global stocks. But again, most investors don't want even all stocks. They want to diversify even further. So while not all stocks are created equally, stocks historically, despite the potential short-term volatility, as everyone listening right now knows, sometimes the stock market goes down. Nobody has forgotten 2008, 2022, the stock market was down about 15 or 16%. So sometimes it goes down. But historically, over the long term, stocks have given investors their highest rewards. But it's not always one particular stock or one particular asset class. Sometimes it's big companies, sometimes it's little companies, sometimes they're domestic, sometimes they're global. So we never know in the short term which of those stock asset classes will do the best. So we invest in all of them. And then most people, to mitigate risk, will do something in addition to stocks. They will also have bonds in their portfolio. We always recommend everybody has a certain amount of cash or safe money with no risk of principal. Many of our clients will also have portfolios that delve into real estate or gold and silver and other precious metals and commodities. So I firmly believe, Laura, that a diversified portfolio that might in some short periods of time reduce your return on investment if you've got all these other asset classes and one particular asset class like large cap stocks is doing the best. There's periods of time where you might say, what am I doing? I should add all my money in those five stocks at the top of the S&P. But over a long period of time, I think you will be grateful for that diversification. I think over a longer period of time, you will not hurt your return on investment and you will greatly diminish your short-term risk. So I guess that's my answer is why to have more than 20 stocks. Have we got time for one more this segment?
Yes, I believe we do. Here's another question from the text line, Bruce. My husband recently passed away. Would it make sense to add my daughter to my bank account now? I also own my home and car. Should I add her to the title or add her to anything else?
First of all, to the texter, I'm so sorry for your loss. I hope you have a good support system, and it sounds like your daughter is you're close to, and friends and family there to help you get through all the things in the short term. I always tell people, first of all, that are grieving, delay the decisions that you can delay. Some things you can't delay and you have to act on quickly. There's whether or not you add your daughter is probably not a decision you need to make in the short term. You can give yourself time to grieve and think about that one and come back to it later. There are certain advantages, and that's why you're probably thinking about adding your daughter to your accounts. But I would also caution there can be some disadvantages. The biggest disadvantage, and again, it depends upon the asset and depends upon the gains, but if your daughter is on as a co-owner, she loses any ability to get what we call a step-up in basis. And what that means, Laura and listeners and texter, if I invest in a stock, let's say I pay a dollar a share for a stock, and now it's trading at $100 a share. If I sell that stock, I have to pay the capital gains tax on $99 share gain. But if I leave that money to my kids, their basis steps up to $100. And if they sell that stock at $100, they don't pay any taxes. But if they're on there with me as a joint owner, they don't get that step up in basis. So I don't want them as a joint owner on an asset like that. Now, a bank account or some of the other things the texter mentioned, it might be fine. So again, there's always advantages and disadvantages, but that's one of the things that when you're grieving that you don't have to decide on immediately. And we wish you well and sorry for your loss. Laura, I think we're about out of time for the first segment.
Yes, we are. It's 8:29 on WCCO. Again, you're listening to Your Money. Ask Bruce Helmer anything this morning. Call us on our talk or text line 651-461-9226. We'll be back after the break. It is 8:34 on WCCO Radio. You are listening to Your Money with the Wealth Enhancement Group's Bruce Helmer. This week, it's an Ask Bruce Anything segment. So we'd love your calls. We'd love your texts. The number for both of them is 651-461-9226. Really would love to hear some more voices on the phone line this morning. Don't be shy. And Bruce, before we jump into a few other questions, you wanted to get back to one of the previous questions and add a little bit more to that. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Laura Oaks. Thank you, listeners, for staying with us. And if you joined us late, yeah, I'm answering any and all questions that I can. In the first half of the show, someone texted in and said, why would anybody have more than 20 stocks if they're self-managing their portfolio? And I kind of assumed based on the question, the texter didn't say this, this was my presumption, that what they were really focusing on is if you look at the markets in recent years, it's really been driven by a handful of well-known companies that many of you have heard of before. And I said, well, diversification makes sense, and I'm not going to, you know, repeat the whole answer I gave. But on the break, I did a little research, and I'll use myself as an example. So I have money in portfolios that Wealth Enhancement runs for clients. In other words, I do the same things that I coach my clients to do. And if I look at those portfolios, again, in a typical model, there might be 100 or more stocks in a full stock portfolio, but I also have portfolios that use funds. But I also do self-manage a small portfolio of my own, and I just looked it up, and I have 70 stocks in my portfolio. But what I do on my individual portfolio is I invest mostly in small cap stocks because I try to find companies that fly below the radar of the big institutional investors. So some of these big companies that we're all familiar with, they're in a lot of funds. You don't have to buy the stock directly. You buy a well-known fund, and that stock might be in that fund, and you have access to the company that way. So I like to fly below the radar on my individual portfolio. So I have 70, which is a lot more than 20, just in that portfolio. But I also did a little research on small cap as compared to large cap in recent years. And since 2000, small cap has actually beat large cap 70% of the time over the last 24 years. And when you think about it, small caps are often at the center of technological innovation. So semiconductor industry, IT services, things that are happening in AI right now. A lot of these companies are going to be small companies that you haven't heard of now that you will in the future. Additionally, some of these nuts and bolts type companies are probably going to benefit from the $1.4 trillion commitment the government made over the next few years to help rebuild America's infrastructure to reshape manufacturing, semiconductors, and energy industry. So I really like small cap, but again, I'll go back to the answer I gave in the first half of the show. I really like diversification. Yes, I like having these big, well-known companies that have done well in recent years, but I don't want only that. I want big companies. I want small companies. I want global companies. I want domestic companies. And diversification, I firmly believe, over a long period of time will benefit most investors. And I just dug up a little evidence of that while I had some time on the break, and I wanted to go back to it really quickly. Laura, back to you.
Good. Another text question, Bruce. This one is long-term care related. Please talk about the cost of assisted living and nursing home services. Many of us are paying our parents' bills, in my case, with her money.
Yeah, this is really a hard one. Thank you, Texter, for listening, and thank you for your question. So I'll do this as briefly as I can, but I'll forewarn everyone this is going to probably take a little while to do it justice. So long-term care insurance is arguably the best way to cover that risk of an extended stay in a healthcare facility, you know, for your spouse or your parents, a loved one, and that cost of spending your assets. You know, you save, you invest, you have your nest egg, and you think you have enough money. And then somebody or more than one somebody ends up with an extended stay in one of these facilities, and it depletes all your assets and you end up with no money. The good news is, even if you end up spending all your money, we're blessed to live and fortunate to live in a country where you don't get thrown into the street. You'll have a place to stay. You become eligible for what's called medical assistance or Medicare. So you'll always be cared for. It might not be the same quality. It might not be the care that you would want in a perfect world, but you're going to get care. But most people are honorable by nature, and they want to pay their own way. They don't want to be, you know, subjected to spending all their money and not leaving anything to loved ones and having someone else pay for their care. I get that. So long-term care insurance is debatably, arguably, one of the best ways to protect yourself from that risk. Now, in recent years, however, a lot of companies that got into the long-term care business actuarially didn't calculate very well their risk exposure and what their cost would be. And many of them have gotten out of the business completely, or many people have seen their premiums spike tremendously. In those cases that I've reviewed with great increases in premium, including my own, I'm a long-term care owner, I can tell you that even with the additional cost, and I'm blessed that I'm able to afford that increased premium, for some people it's a struggle. And again, I work with those clients to figure out what we can do, how we can pay for it, do we need to make alterations to the policy that they have, and so forth. It's still way, way, way better than not having it and running the risk of having an extended stay in one of these facilities without any insurance. Having said that, I recognize the fact that most people listening, most Americans, have not insured that risk, so they're going to try to self-insure or pay for it out of their own pocket with their own assets. There are other strategies and other things that we can do other than long-term care insurance to mitigate some of that cost and mitigate some of that risk. And now I'm getting into a rabbit hole that's too deep to go down on a radio on a show like this. We would have to do that, you know, individually, one-on-one, and look at specific circumstances. But in terms of what the cost actually is, there's obviously a lot of variance to that, right? There's a lot of different types of care. How much care, quality of care? Do you just need someone to check in on you once a day? Are you in a senior facility? Do you have in-home health care? Do you need, you know, more service? Do you need somebody to take you to the bathroom and care? You know, so there's different levels. But if you look at all the various options out there, I think this number is still pretty close. The average cost is about $7,500 a month. And so that's, what, $90,000 a year. Now, again, obviously it can be more expensive or it can be less expensive. So that's the bad news. It's very, very expensive. The good news is the average stay is only a little bit over 2 years, I think, something like 24 months. So that can vary. Sometimes that can be days. Sometimes that can be decades. But the average stay is a couple of years. So for most people, they're not going to end up experiencing a situation where they spend everything, they deplete all their assets, and there's nothing left. But there's no question this is a huge cost. It is something we need to plan for in advance. You don't want to be ready to enter, you know, a senior assisted living facility and go, gosh, we should do some planning for this. I mean, the time to do it is years before you ever need it. And so long-term care is a possibility, but that's not the right answer for everybody. But there's other things that you can do to plan for this possibility, because the cost is extremely high, and that's the reality of the world that we live in. And it's not, you know, it's not going to go away if you ignore it. So I encourage everybody to plan for it in advance to the extent that you're able to. And again, there are some strategies that we can do if we dig a little deeper, you know, in a one-on-one type situation. But that discussion is not applicable, I don't think, to a general audience on this program. Laura?
Okay, great. Another question. Where do you start when trying to figure out how much monthly income you're going to need in retirement?
Boy, that's a great question. Thank you. So what I tell people is you don't know how much you're going to spend, right? Because you've never been retired before. The prevailing wisdom to people that have never retired think that when they retire, they're automatically going to spend less money. And there's some logic to that thought process, right? A lot of costs associated with work are going to go away. You're no longer going to contribute to your 401k or your retirement plan. That's a lot of money every year. Maybe you've got travel costs getting to and from your work. Maybe you eat out a lot more when you go to work. You have lunches and stuff or whatever. Clothes. You know, I probably won't buy suits anymore when I retire. So your clothing expenses might go down. So people think that when I retire, I'm going to spend a lot less. But I've been doing this, Laura, for over 40 years. And I can tell you, I cannot think of a single client that did not spend more the first several years after they retire than the years leading up to retirement. And the reason why, and I don't like this term, but people know what I mean when I say it, you have a bucket list. I like live it list, but you have a list of things that you want to do. You've been waiting for retirement. You've been waiting until you have time. So you want to pursue your passions. It might be, maybe you want to go on an African safari. It might just be hunting and fishing or golfing more. It might be travel. Maybe you want to climb a mountain. I don't know, but you've got this list of things and they take money. So you go do these things. And so in my experience, the first roughly 5 years or so after people retire, they spend a lot more. Then they get to a point where they've either exhausted everything on their live it list or bucket list, and or they're not as fit anymore. Their knees are bad. They can't hike, you know, like they used to. So you become a little more sedentary, and then spending does go down. And then it might spike again later in life because you go get those knees replaced or those hips replaced or you have other healthcare issues. So the idea that we're going to automatically spend less at retirement is simply not true. So back to the original question, how do we calculate what it's going to be? I always try to plan for, and it's not always possible, but I try to plan for 100% of your working income at retirement. So whatever you were taking home net after taxes when you were working, I would like that to be the goal when you retire. The prevailing wisdom in my industry says 70% of your working income. And that is oftentimes the reality of what happens. But I would say that's, you know, that's not the desired goal, at least not the goal that I would have. That's sometimes the unfortunate result. And you can survive probably on 70% of your working income. But how much fun can you have and how much of those bucket list things can you actually do on 70%? So I strive for 100% of working income. And oftentimes that is possible. I've got a lot of clients that make as much or more at retirement than they did while they were working. It takes planning to do that. It takes planning to get there, but it is possible. And the other thing is, you know, you can kind of look at expenses that aren't going to change when you retire. So there's certain things that are just factored in, your property taxes, your insurance costs or whatever. Those aren't going to change much. And when we do a future value forecast for a client, we do build in an inflation factor. So whatever it costs you to live today the way you want, those costs are going to go up over time, right? 5 years from now, it's not going to be the same as it is today, 10 years from now, and so on. So we factor that in. and we assume a rate of return aggregately on all of your money that's reasonable, that's logical, that is a fair expectation. And then we forecast out and we say, we know where you are today. Now, based on these assumptions on how much you're going to spend with an inflation factor and how much you're going to earn, does your net worth get bigger or smaller or stay the same? If it stays the same or gets bigger, it's a slam dunk. You can spend that much money. You're never going to run out. But even if it shrinks, as long as that shrinkage is slow and it doesn't go to zero before you die, you're still going to be fine. Now, the problem is nobody knows when you're going to die, right? Financial planning would be so much easier if we knew exactly when we were going to die. But we always project out to age 100, and I tell my clients, look, if you live beyond 100 and you run out of money after you're 100, my guess is you're not going to care at that point anyway, but we've got enough money to make sure you get to age 100. So it's a little bit trial and error in my experience. People tell me how much they think they're going to spend. And then after they retire, I will usually have a review meeting maybe 6 months later and say, okay, you're pulling X amount out of your accounts. Is it still feel tight, like you need more money? Or are you taking too much? Is your checking account growing and you're not spending everything that you're withdrawing out of your investments with us? Should we slow it down? We can make alterations as we go. But there's always going to be a little bit of trial and error there because you've never retired before. But again, just have an expectation that probably for a few years you're going to spend more. And that's okay if you do. We just have to account for that and plan for that when we try to forecast it. So, and then there's other people that say, I saw something recently. So 70% of your working income is sort of the standard rule of thumb, which I don't like. I saw something recently. I saw the headline. I didn't read the whole article. But Susie Orman, who some of our listeners might be aware of, is a financial guru in the country. She thinks you need, what was it, 10 times your annual income saved to be able to retire. So if you make $100,000 a year, she thinks you can retire on $1 million, 10 times what you're earning. So there's different ways of looking at that, but we all spend differently. There is no one size fits all formula for that. We're snowflakes. We're all different. We're all going to spend differently. And it really comes down to, and I told you this was going to be a long answer, it really comes down to your goals and objectives and your core values. What's important to you and how do you want to live? Laura, I have a lot of clients that that have the assets that they could spend a lot more, but they choose not to. They have a simple lifestyle and they're happy that way. They don't want to do a lot of traveling. They like, you know, gardening at home and they like, you know, it doesn't take much. I have other people that want to do a lot of things that take a lot of money and everything in between. So it really is going to come down to how do you want to live? And then it's my job to tell you if you can afford to do those things, or if you're spending too much and you're going to run out of money. And it's been suggested to me before, boy, I bet it's hard to tell a client they're spending too much and they have to spend less. I wouldn't want to have that conversation. And I would tell you that's never been a hard conversation because people would rather know now than when they're running out of money in 10 years. So that's an easy conversation for me to tell somebody they can't spend as much as they're spending. So great text, great question. I wish I had a specific, easy answer for you, but it's complicated and it's going to be different in every situation.
Great. A few minutes left in the show. If you want to get a question into Bruce on the phone or on our talk and text line, 651-461-9226. Another texter, Bruce. My wife and I are contemplating buying a second home in Florida. We have been down there 3 times looking at homes and have found one in an area and a type of home that we would really like to purchase. However, it would require financing 3/4 of it for the next couple of years. I'm just having a difficult time borrowing for this home, especially when I feel the properties down there are overvalued. What are your thoughts?
So, again, complicated question with a lot of variables that I probably don't have time to get into in this format. But I would say a second home or even the home that you live in, yes, you want to be economically smart. You want to be economically efficient. You don't want to pay too much. You don't want to borrow when interest rates are high. All those things that economically, you know, come into play in the decision-making process. But I think it's not just an economic decision. I think it's a lifestyle choice. I've done things in my life that I know economically don't make sense, but I did it for the quality of life. whether it's, you know, be a member of a country club. Somebody told me once, well, if you join a country club, it'll pay for itself. You'll do business deals out there, blah, blah, blah. Never. I've never done that ever. In fact, I don't even hardly play golf, but a handful of times a year. But there's things about the lifestyle that it's worth it to me, even though economically it probably doesn't make sense. Buying a property in Florida, especially with the weather we've been having down there recently and on the way again, you could say you're crazy. Why would you do that? But if it's important to you to snowbird, to get out of the northern climate in the winter when it's cold and icy, if that's a priority, you know, a financial professional can help you look at the numbers and do it as efficiently as possible and see if it's feasible or not. Again, I've told clients before that have wanted to do something like that, hey, I don't think you can afford it. I know you really want to do that. I just don't think it's reasonable based on your economic situation. So I can't tell you that. I don't know enough about you, but I think if you think of it as lifestyle more than an economic decision, it might help you make the decision. Laura, we've got time for at least one more, and I know you told me you had a question or two. You got anything on your mind?
Well, I snuck in one of mine a couple of questions back, but I do have another one. I have another one. When can you pull money from your 401k without being penalized?
So, great question. Most retirement plans, including 401ks, limit restrict, but there can be exceptions. But let's say limit your accessibility until you're 59 and a half years old. Now, again, there's an exception or two. I'm not going to go down that road. But if you think in terms of, I really don't have access to this money until I'm 59 and a half, that's the safe way to look at it. The exception being Roth. So if I change it from 401k or company retirement plan to individual retirement account, on a traditional IRA, again, your assets are tied up until 59 and a half. But on a Roth, because you don't get a deduction for the contribution and you've already paid taxes on the money that you put in, you could actually take that back out before you're 59 and a half with no tax, no penalty, no detrimental impact. But if you take your earnings or your gains before 59 and a half, then you're going to get whacked with taxes and penalties. So for young people, again, I really like the Roth, even though there isn't a short-term tax savings with the deduction. The fact that if I leave it until I'm 59 and a half and it'll be tax-free, and the fact that I have more accessibility, at least to my basis or my principal or my contributions, there's a lot of advantages in that liquidity. The thing I've always disliked most about tax-deferred plans is the fact that I have to tie that money up until I'm 59 and a half and can't use it for home purchases, home improvements, weddings, and so forth, lifestyle. So 59 and a half is the key number to remember, Laura, and I'm keeping an eye on the clock. I know you're going to tell me, you're going to give me the hook, and we're about out of time.
Well, I'm going to give you the hook because you just talked about people getting whacked, too, so I'm picturing somebody coming getting whacked with a club at the knees. We don't want to end the show on a negative note like that, but we will end now. And, Bruce, this was so much fun. Thank you very much. Such excellent advice as always. Your Money with Bruce Helmer every Sunday here, 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Please join us again next week on CCL. Take care.